Hey, welcome, committee members and guests. We will begin the Ashland Park and Recreation Commission Senior Advisory Committee, ASAC, Monday, May 8th, 2023. It's 3:30. We're meeting via Zoom. And first on our agenda will be approval of minutes from the March 13th, 2023 meeting, and I'd ask for a motion to approve unless there's anything that needs to be discussed, updated, or changed.
I move to approve the minutes.
Do you have a second?
I'll second.
Okay. All in favor can signify by raising their hand. Aye. Okay. The minutes are recorded for the record. I had no additions or deletions, and I was informed that we have no public input today, so we will just proceed right to our number five item, which is our guest speaker today, and I'm going to turn it over to Director Glatt to bring us in.
So thank you very much, Mike. I want to thank Lauren Kramer from the Oregon State University Extension on Family and Community Health. She is kind enough to be here today to present a shortened version of a presentation that we've heard about and that was very good on disaster preparedness for older adults and caregivers, which I think is a particular twist. We've talked about different aspects of disaster preparedness here, and we've done a lot of, pretty much every year we've tried to do one for our patrons, but I think Dr. Kramer will give us some particular insight as an advisory body about what to think about in our structures in our community for older adults and for caregivers. And with that, I will turn it over to you, Lauren, and please feel free to add any other introduction you would like about your bio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you all this afternoon. I'm glad I could join you via Zoom. It's a little easier than making the drive down from the Gorge. I'm in my 13th year with Oregon State University Extension Service and have been teaching community level disaster preparedness courses for almost my entire time. And over the past year and a half or so, I've been really looking more deeply at the impacts of wildfire smoke on human health and long-term impacts. And we've just begun over the last probably 6 to 8 months or so, really upping our awareness and data collection around wildfire smoke. We've developed and deployed a new air quality monitoring network. So hoping to have more information to help us protect our health better. I have some slides I'm going to share, so let me get those just up on screen, and I'm just going to do a quick sound check. Is my voice loud enough for everyone to hear coming through okay? All right, good. Sometimes that doesn't always work. So as Eileen said, this is part of a presentation that I gave a couple of years ago, time flies when you're in a pandemic, to the Oregon Rural Health Association, kind of their focus on aging. And so my focus for the presentation was really to look at how older adults and their caregivers might prepare differently or a little better as they hopefully build their awareness about why older adults may be particularly vulnerable to disasters. And so I think all good stories start with a little bit of an origin story. So my origin story is that I was raised in the Girl Scout program. My mom was my troop leader and my grandmother was a Girl Scout as well. So we had lots of generations of Girl Scouts, and I always learned about how to be prepared, whether it was on a hiking trail or setting up camps or just in my own home. And that has been an interest and a skill set and a trait that I've carried with me throughout my life. And so in March of 2020, actually, I took my first CERT training, and I was honestly a little nervous. Like, are we going to get deployed to respond to this pandemic? And part of my role is working in public health, and sure enough, that was something that I ended up working in quite a bit over the last several years, but not necessarily how I was concerned I would be. So that's how I got my start, and I continue to be interested in and passionate about, both personally and professionally, how to prepare communities and our state for disasters. So I would love to hear just a couple things from you. We don't necessarily need to share these out loud, but these are kind of fun things for me to reflect on in classes, and I always ask some sort of introductory question when I'm teaching. So if you all don't mind humoring me and putting into the chat just sharing one aspect of disaster preparedness that nags at you, and then if you could share a number on a scale of 1 being least and 10 being most, how prepared you feel for disaster. And we'll say wildfire right now, because I know every disaster is a little bit different. So let's think about wildfire, since that's something we all have to be thinking about. And I'll return to those shortly. So I'll give you a few minutes. Aspect that nags at you and how prepared you feel. So just a little roadmap for my short time with you today. We'll address why might older adults be more vulnerable during disasters. I want to make sure you leave today knowing the three steps to preparedness, which include making a plan, making a kit, and being informed. It's all about those three things. And then I'll share a couple of follow-up pieces of information and tools you can use to continue on your preparedness journey, whether that's for you and your household, or as it sounds like, the ways that you'll educate your community and bring this out further into Ashland and surrounding area. So this is an area where I do think you could unmute if you want. I'll invite a little conversation. Why would you guess older adults might be more vulnerable during disasters? What things come to mind, or what thoughts do you have?
Decreased mobility.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Sandy. Decreased mobility is a big reason. Yep. Anything else?
Transportation.
Yeah, transportation challenges, definitely, Kathy. Thank you.
Awareness of the emergency.
Yes, that's a big one. Thank you, Commissioner Bachman. That's certainly an issue, especially with different technology comfort levels across the older adult spectrum, connectivity issues in a disaster, if there are power outages or internet outages, those are big challenges. Maybe one more.
Healthcare conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. So older adults as a population tend to have more chronic conditions than the general population, which, as someone noted, can affect mobility, it can affect our thinking and memory, so there's all sorts of things, medications, assistive devices, all of those things. So the next couple of slides include some photos from previous disasters, and I just want to acknowledge that they can be hard to see, but my hope is that we can look at why some of these things are hard or challenging for older adults and then think through some solutions. So I don't want to take us to a dark place and just leave us there. But I do want to show you some of the evidence and research for why older adults tend to have bigger challenges in the aftermath of disasters. All right, so by 2020, one in five Americans will be 65 years or older. From data, we know that older adults are among the least prepared for disasters and have the highest rate of disaster-related deaths, both during and following disasters. As we've all experienced in Oregon and across the country and the globe, the number of disasters is on the rise. So we have more what the federal government calls billion-dollar disasters every year than we've ever experienced in the past. So those are continuing to increase and be very devastating for the communities they impact. Generally, two-thirds of seniors have no emergency plan. There's not a conversation or a backup or things that they can fall on when there are emergencies. And as you've all pointed out, older adults often have medical conditions that can make evacuating or being in a different place, a shelter, or things like that much more challenging. So these are the images that I referenced, just showing you some of those particular challenges. So as we discussed, mobility issues can make it very difficult to evacuate. There's been a lot of research in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina about what happened and where the failures were and why. And they have seen that more than 75% of the people who died following the hurricane were over 60. So there's huge disparities in the death rate by age, which is something that's very concerning. Additionally, this shows a different hurricane impact in Dickinson, Texas, following the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. This is a picture that got a lot of coverage in the media of people in an assisted living facility that, again, were unable to evacuate. We see the assisted mobility device here, the walker that the woman is sitting in, and armpit deep in water because of the inability to leave and go someplace else. In this image, we see a mix of ages and stages of life and health. This is in California, where over 200 people were waiting outside a memorial building trying to get in for sheltering and were ultimately turned away due to lack of space. Partly due to COVID, they were trying to limit the number of people in the building, but also just had more evacuees than they could manage. And this is one of the things that concerns me with sheltering, is especially for folks who have mobility or sleep issues or medical devices that they count on, or even just the challenges of dementia and being able to adapt to a new situation that's going to be very loud and very busy and very different from what they may be used to. Similar type of image coming out of California due to fire evacuation, a senior retirement community all packed onto the bus trying to figure out which shelter to take folks to as those shelters filled up quickly. This one is in Oregon. This is the Oregon State Fairgrounds following the Labor Day fires of 2020. So again, just to focus on older adults having particular vulnerabilities when it comes to disaster and their ability to safely have a place to go that's going to meet and be able to accommodate their needs. And so this is something that both older adults, their families, and caregivers need to be thinking about as we face potential future disasters in our communities. And then many of us remember the heat dome incident in 2020 in June. Many of the people who perished during that heat dome were older adults. Around 81% of the folks who passed away were older, and many of them socially isolated. So we also know that having a strong social network or a network of caregivers or family is very much a protective factor. I'm sure you all are aware of these, but what are some of the types of disasters we can expect in Oregon? Mentioned wildfire. What are some others that come to mind? Again, feel free to unmute if you'd like. Try to build a little participation.
Flood.
Earthquake.
Flood, earthquakes. Yep. Yeah, you got it. A couple others I'll add. So we mentioned wildfire. One that I talked about and I'm getting more interested in is smoke and poor air quality in the aftermath of those fires, whether they're in Oregon or outside of Oregon. We all share the air. We also tend to see big infrastructure challenges when there is an evacuation. So even if people are able to leave, they may not be able to get where they want to go without sitting in traffic for a really long time, or have other challenges that they face as they're trying to evacuate. And this is another thing I'm sure many of you have either heard about or experienced or may have some concerns with. So power companies are now utilizing a tool or a shutdown process called a public safety power shutoff when fire danger is really high. And I was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago talking about how we plan for this. And one of the big considerations is thinking through communities where there are folks who are medically vulnerable. And so the power companies are asking community residents where public safety power shutoffs can happen to self-declare and call in if they would like to be on a specific list that would allow that household or that individual to receive additional advance notice or additional support. So this is something, if you work with older adults who need electricity to power or charge medical devices or keep medications cold or support them with their sleep overnight, they need to be added to those lists by opting in. And then the power companies will know that those folks exist and ideally where their address is, and can provide either backup generators during extended power outages or other support to those individuals in addition to the advance warning. And this is something we actually just did for my household. My 9-year-old son has a new type 1 diabetes diagnosis, and his insulin pump and his insulin all need electricity to keep things cold and powered. And so we opted into this system to hopefully get more advance notice. And it was a very easy process. I just emailed Pacific Power and they got back to me within 24 hours or less, probably, to just say, confirmed, thank you for letting us know. And so this doesn't have, there's not a lot of promotion, I would say. So this is something I think, as you think about your role, is making sure that vulnerable folks in your community, regardless of their age, are signed up to receive that notice of these power shutoffs. We had one last summer that fortunately was only 13 hours or so long, but California has experienced them for days at a time. And so we definitely want folks to be able to prepare for that ahead of time and think through backup plans and backups to the backup plan, especially if they're depending on electricity, again, to survive. And so this is something that I would really encourage folks to just be aware of. And I did put in Ashland into the map search earlier when I was updating the PowerPoint, and both Jackson and Josephine are highlighted as counties in Oregon that can be impacted by these PSPSs, they're calling them. So that's something to definitely be aware of. And I should have mentioned to Eileen, and I talked about the flow for this, I'll have some time at the end for questions. So I'm not super great at multitasking if there are questions coming into the chat. So if there are, I'll address those with some time at the end. Thank you. But feel free to put them in the chat so you remember what you would like to ask. When we get in the gorge, I'm not sure if these happen down where you all are, but we get crazy ice storms that will freeze up I-84, which is our main thoroughfare into the gorge, and that prevents food pantries and grocery stores and other utilities and support systems from getting into the region. And so we've had days and weeks during the winter where I-84 has been closed for hours, days at a time, and we start to see the impacts in our shelves at grocery stores and food pantries, which certainly impacts everyone, but especially can impact older adults if they're relying on services that need to go on the roadways. Someone mentioned earthquakes. That's definitely a big one. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about earthquakes or the Cascadia subduction zone. That's a big part of the long form presentation. But just know that we are at risk for earthquakes, particularly along the coastline. And there is a big one predicted to happen at some point in the next 200 or so years. The chances increase every year, but the cadence of that Cascadia subduction zone earthquake is about every 300 to 500 years, and we're over 300 years at this point. So could happen tomorrow, it could happen in 200 years. Those things are really hard to plan for, but extremely important to think about and try to prepare as best we can. So what are emergency managers planning for and telling folks? Generally, they're suggesting that all Oregonians be minimally 2 weeks ready. I live and work in a rural community, as I noted, that has sometimes one road in and out of our community for resources. And so my best advice is to actually increase that two or threefold even, and try to plan for 4 to 6 weeks ready. We know, as we've seen other disasters unfold across the country, how long it takes, especially when resources are going to be diverted initially to bigger population centers where the need is greater. Oftentimes, rural communities don't receive services or support for many, many weeks, and by the time they happen, it can be quite minimal. So when I'm teaching out in the community, I try to get people to think about at least 4 to 6 weeks if possible, and that includes all the things that we need to live. So it's food and water and medication and first aid supplies and pet food, all that stuff. It's a lot to prepare. I recognize that. But one of the things we also talk through a lot is doing it stepwise. So it's not something you have to do all at once. Even if it's one extra can of food every time you grocery shop, all of that adds up. And if we do 1 or 2% a week, then by the time we get to the end of a year, we're a whole lot more prepared than we were when we started. So part of that preparedness, the first step, is making a plan. It's really simple. I know it can be a hard conversation, but it really is just sitting down and talking with your household, your neighbors, your coworkers, people in your community that you know you may rely on. And so it's really just discussing and planning what you think should happen. Again, so for folks thinking about their caregiving role or the older adults that you serve in your roles as community members and partners, thinking through what is our plan as an organization and what's my plan as a community member or as an individual household, and thinking through what do we do for an evacuation? What do we do for a shelter in place situation? I think my perfect dream disaster, if I had to survive one, would be one in which I can shelter in place because my household is pretty well stocked. And doing the work I do, I try to practice what I preach. And so if I could plan to be at home where all of our stuff is, that would be ideal. Evacuations are definitely harder, but those are also important. And when we were at risk of fire danger and level one evacuation a couple years ago, I had totes lined up by the back door, ready to go in the event that we moved up to level 2 or 3. And so those are things that I know as people get, unfortunately, more and more familiar with fire risk and evacuation, that a lot of households end up having some of those totes lined up by the back door filled with those necessary supplies throughout the late summer and fall. I think the other important thing is knowing how to communicate. So a lot of times text messaging is going to be the fastest, easiest, kind of low bandwidth way to connect with relatives, loved ones, or other caregivers. I have this note here, the simpler the better. So if you've ever tried to send a picture or video when you're not on Wi-Fi, you may notice that it takes a long time to get that message through. And if all of us in a region or a whole state are trying to send messages to people, the shorter the better. Those are going to get through much faster. So I am okay is a super short, simple message that we can train folks to both send and receive and then understand. The first time I saw that from a colleague training me, I was like, amok, but it's I'm okay. So if you remember that, plant that in your brain for the next time there's a need to communicate, you can share that message out. Another important thing about making a plan is knowing escape and evacuation routes based on ability. So 80% of us will experience a physical disability at some point in our lifetime. Might be that knee replacement or hip replacement you've been planning for or needing to have for a couple years. And so it's important to think, maybe I'm able-bodied today, but I might not be 6 months from now or a year from now when it's time for me to evacuate. So thinking through plans that can adapt based on your abilities at the time. And again, evacuation, thinking through routes out of your community. So many of us rely on our phone maps, which guide us along. But when I'm working with community members, I encourage all of them to have paper maps so you can think through and see actual alternate routes out of your community. And sometimes it's nice to practice those ahead of time in a calm state so that you've driven it once or twice already and you're not trying to chart a new route from one place to another for the very first time under duress. And similarly, if it's in a building and you always take the north entrance and exit, maybe figuring out where you need to go to get outside of your buildings. I think for those of you that run programs or senior centers or parks and rec things, practicing some of these evacuations or announcing at the start of programs something simple like, should we need to evacuate, please, just like they do on the airplane, please notice the exits on either side of us, short and simple. And then at least we've kind of prompted people to think through that. The other thing, I would ask for a quick show of hands, how many of you have ever been on a cruise? I've only had the luxury of going on one cruise. But if you have, you know that as soon as you push off from shore, they do a muster drill, right? And so the purpose of the muster drill is to get everyone to go back to their muster station and find their life jacket and figure out which lifeboat they would go to if needed. And it's not to freak everyone out as soon as they've gotten onto the boat to say, we're going to sink, here's what you do. It's really just to prepare folks. And so I encourage people, it's really another term for situational awareness, but doing a mental muster when you're in a new building or a new environment or a new condition is really helpful, just to think as you look around, where is my nearest exit and who would I communicate with this week or this month if there were an emergency, and what is my plan? So the next step is having a kit. Again, our main needs that we need to think through are food, water, and hopefully if we're drinking and eating like normally, we're going to have waste like normally. So thinking through those kind of three basic needs. We want to plan for kind of a typical amount of calories. We don't want to be restricting food while we're in a disaster. And ideally, we're eating kind of normal, familiar foods, if at all possible. Adds a lot of stress if you go from eating a healthy whole food diet to only MREs. So I would encourage folks, as you're planning and making kits, to think about what might be some normal foods that I like to eat. If you normally eat canned soup here and there and boxes of mac and cheese, those are great things to have in your kit. You also want to plan on a minimum of a gallon of water per person per day. And I would even invite you to challenge yourself, grab a gallon of water sometime, maybe on a day that you can track, and see how far that goes. It really isn't a lot of water, and that's for your hydration and your hygiene. And so those are things we want people to think through, that that gallon doesn't last long. By the time you've drank it, washed your hands with it, cooked with it, you're not going to be able to have long, luxurious showers with a gallon of water a day, but that's going to help you survive. Hey, silly me, didn't grab them down, but I've got my pee and poop buckets. Let me even show you up in the corner of my very messy office. Those orange buckets behind me are pee and poop buckets that I use for teaching and training. I've got a set at my home as well. They're labeled. And those are just in the event of emergency and public sewer and sanitation systems go offline, we'll still be able to have a place to go to the bathroom. And so I often encourage people, it can feel like a lot to have to go out and buy things or invest in new equipment, but so many of us have a lot of these items already in our homes. I'm sure many of you have canned or packaged food in various places around the kitchen or in cupboards or storage. So that is already there. There's little sources of water kind of tucked away throughout our homes as well, but it definitely does take some thinking and planning ahead to make sure all of those needs can be met for everyone in our homes, particularly those folks who are going to be most vulnerable. So thinking through kind of how might one do this, there's a lot of options. So I mentioned the kind of one can or one box at a time approach. That's a great way to do it piecemeal. Other folks want to assemble their own kits and get it all put together and kind of fix it and forget it. And then I would say there's this third option of investing like in the whole dehydrated food setup, where you've got, you know, 56 meals in one carton, and those can last for years and years before they expire. And those tend to be a little on the pricier side, but the also a kind of fix it and forget it model that helps people think, well, at least I know I've got all my food somewhere stored up in our home in case there's a disaster emergency. If we wait until after the disaster, we're often met with chaos. So on the left is a picture of store shelves after the Fukushima Tohoku earthquake in Japan. And then on the right is following an earthquake in Chile, where you can see most of the contents of the store shelves have fallen onto the ground. It's going to be very difficult to find what folks need at that point. Again, if we're thinking about a gallon per person per day and the 2 weeks ready minimum challenge, that would be 14 gallons per person that we want stored up somewhere in our homes. That can look a lot of different ways, but here are some examples of how other Oregonians have stored up their water, jugs and cases and gallons and all sorts of things. And here's a close-up zoom-in of those pee and poop buckets. And these are adhesive labels that can go and they're waterproof right on the outside of the buckets. And these I can share a link shortly with where to download those stickers. And we got them printed at a local printer. And that's kind of a nice giveaway for tabling or disaster preparedness events or opportunities that you might have to share these resources out with the community. In terms of first aid kits, those are all over the market in terms of costs and what is included in them. A lot of times the basic supplies don't go super far and they're filled with tons of Band-Aids. So I usually recommend that folks either get a starter kit or make their own that's going to be really useful for them based on the medical needs and the people that they're caring for in their own households or workplaces. And especially for older adults, we want to think through different medical needs. So I was in a meeting recently, I need to add dentures to this image, but we were talking through older adult evacuation and the woman from the Red Cross said, whatever you do, if you're helping an elder to evacuate, please make sure you get their dentures. We can often get medications in shelters if we need, we can often find glasses, but it is so hard to find replacement dentures and it takes a really long time in the aftermath of disaster. So there's things like that, that if it were to happen in the middle of the night and those happen to be in the cleaning container, we may not think through, oh, gotta grab my teeth. And so those are things to think through in support of older adults as we're trying to plan for disasters, kind of those main medical things. And one of Oregon's emergency management directors, Althea Rizzo, had a brilliant idea. She talked about having a pair of old shoes and your medical equipment, anything that is a must-have, so that might be an extra set of glasses and maybe an extra set of medications, all in a plastic bag that's tied or hung or just below the bed. And the reason it's just below the bed is if you have to evacuate in the middle of the night, you've got a pair of shoes, so you're not having to walk on broken glass in the event of an earthquake, and you've got everything that you need to get out of the house quickly, also if it's a fire. And I thought that was great. We've got our little bags under the bed at home with our old shoes and flashlights and a water bottle. And then the last step is being informed. So one of the main ways that we get information in Oregon is relatively new. Oregon has a contract now with the Everbridge system to do statewide alert systems. So every county now has access to OR Alert. They use the Everbridge platform. And so all that they ask is for each person to go in and enter where you would like to receive your alerts for. There are a couple barriers to OR Alert. So one is that you can enter several addresses, but they all have to be within the same county. And I've talked to the people and I've explained that that doesn't work for all of us. In the Gorge, for example, there's a lot of inter-county movement for schools and work, and I'm sure that's similar for you all, for many of your residents. So thinking about how might we push back a little bit to include other counties. But for now, you could enter home, school and work in the Everbridge system, and then you would receive alerts for each of those locations, again, given that they were all in one county. If you do work across county lines, you just have to create two accounts, and those would then allow you to receive an alert for Jackson and one for Josephine, if that were the case. A lot of information now is also going out through social media, so I would encourage you and the older adults you work with, when it makes sense, not everyone's on social media, but that happens to be where a lot of county sheriffs share information, there are fire watch pages, seems that that tends to be one of the main places where folks are wanting to receive and go for information. And then I would say, again, back to situational awareness, knowing where stuff is. A lot of times it's extra stressful when you're trying to find shutoffs or valves or different things in the middle of a disaster. So knowing where the water and the gas and the electricity shutoffs are in your home or apartment or senior living facility, if those are room by room or all in a block somewhere else, those are helpful things to know. If you are caring for someone that you're helping to move into one of those spaces, kind of talking with them and asking questions about what their plans are for disasters. And there are some really great resources out there, including care plans from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, as well as just websites if you kind of search up how to evaluate or what questions to ask assisted living when thinking through emergency preparedness. And they all should have a well-written, well-thought-out plan for these things. Just a couple more things. All of our skills that we may have, whether it's first aid or wound care or food preservation or knowing how to get the water out of your water heater, each of those skills that we have already will serve us and suit us well in times of disaster and need. A lot of us will be supporting the people in our immediate vicinity. So that might be your coworkers if you happen to be at work, or your neighbors or co-residents in an assisted living site. And then if things are lost or destroyed during disaster, the Oregon Department of Human Services can provide a lot of support and replacement costs, whether it's for devices, for mobility, or if food is lost due to long-term power outages or fires, there's generally resources to help support, at least in part, to replace those materials and items. So what are some of the benefits of being more prepared? Just wrapping up here, there are many. I think for me, one of the main ones is just trying to decrease that anxiety a little bit of worry and making sure I know what I will do. And as a mom, making sure that I've got a plan for my kiddos as we think about these emergencies and disasters we may face. And I know for folks caring for their parents or other elders, that can be a stress too. So some of the benefits are just being able to decrease that stress a bit. Hopefully it also means that you're better prepared and able to shelter in place rather than having to go to a shelter away from home and away from all the things you know and those comforts. I like to include this because we are used to spending a lot of time preparing for some of life's big events, whether it's a wedding or the birth of a child or a retirement or a big trip. So I often encourage people just to think about disaster preparedness as one of them. We may not get this to catch on, but I sometimes joke about making a disaster preparedness registry like you would for a baby shower or a wedding, and slowly ticking off those things that you could utilize in the aftermath of an emergency or disaster, just in case. And I work a lot with my two boys about how to be prepared, especially when we're out hiking or camping, and it's something that I think will serve them across their whole life, and it works throughout the generation. So if we can work with our community elders to help them be a little bit more prepared, then we can also work with our youth in the same way to encourage them to be prepared and learn from the generations before them. I've done a lot of writing and course development on these topics around preparedness. And so one of the things that I and a couple colleagues worked on is a free online Cascadia subduction zone. That's what that CSZ stands for. And there are modules for each region. And so this is also available in Spanish. And then we developed a set of materials and publications, or Survival Basics is the name of the series. And they cover kind of one topic at a time. So you can see the screenshots along the bottom: water, kits, food, stress, sanitation, waste management. That's where you'll learn more about those pee and poop buckets. And so that you can find at this website, Cascadia Prepare, and that's case sensitive. You can see the top one has the capital C, and the bottom link has the lowercase c. So that, again, I can also put in the chat, but those are a couple of great places to find more of these resources if you want to do more reading or print any of these out to make available for residents, patrons, clients, whomever you work with in your world. So that is what I've got. I'm going to pause here and see what questions maybe popped in, and then just open it up for additional questions. And that's a really powerful percentage. So current proportion of Ashlanders age 65 plus is 26.9, so significantly higher than the U.S. as a whole or Oregon.
Yeah, that's, you know, it was 2050 before it got to 1 in 5 in the U.S., and it's like, hey, we're
already there, yeah. for sure.
Eileen, did you have a question?
Well, I want to thank you, Lauren. That was such an excellent presentation. And I know I've heard so many presentations, and you managed to have a number of new things that I personally made some notes on, as well as for our organization. I'm sure it was quite eye-opening for some people, even more so. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And I've often wondered, in the older care facilities, how do they prepare those facilities for disaster?
Well, I know that the Northridge people who lost their entire building got everybody out with something like 10 minutes of notice. Mm. So they do drills. And then we have here in Mountain Meadows, we have people who are focused on that as a committee as well. I was just going to observe that one of the other things besides the skewed demographics here in Ashland is the phenomenal number of tourists that we have, visitors to the area. And I saw what that was like where I used to live in Lake Arrowhead, where they just had this horrendous storm this winter, where people were at like Airbnbs, had no idea that they were going to end up with a 8 to 9 foot of snowstorm. So they didn't have the clothing, the food, the medicine, anything that they needed. It was pretty awful. So we have a similar kind of thing where people who are visitors can be, you know, roaming around trying to find exits and so forth. So that's another thing. I don't know if there's any attention to that. And we tend to attract older visitors.
Right.
We have the college, but we also have a lot of older people coming to town.
We're working on a document in the Gorge, and when we complete the format, I'm happy to share it with you all. You'd need to update it for your local resources, but it's something that we hope Airbnb and VRBO renters can just download off of a website and slip into their welcome binders. Almost all of those rental homes have the welcome binder with the Wi-Fi and restaurants and yada yada, but it would just be kind of a one or two page, like, hey, if you happen to be at our home during a disaster, here's what you need to know. And so we're encouraging our documents locally to have some information about evacuation routes and local gorge emergency preparedness pages, and maybe even saying you should sign up for OR Alert while you're here. Here's our home address, then you'll at least get notification. Oregon will have the ability to push out those alerts, kind of like the Amber Alert protocol, if it's a statewide disaster or a declared state of emergency. But there are a few more rules with county emergency management and sheriffs for when they're allowed to push it out like that. It has to be pretty serious. But that's something we're going to try, at least. We know it won't hit everybody, but if we can try to get into our local hotels and Airbnbs with that kind of slip in the binder sheet, hopefully that'll at least give a little more information.
I'd love you to share that, and I will definitely help share it out.
Any other questions for Lauren? Go ahead, Natalie.
Thanks. I was just curious, right towards the beginning, Lauren, you mentioned that 2/3 of older adults aren't prepared. And I'm wondering if there's what the reasons are for that lack of preparation, because I see that as another obstacle. So how can we overcome that?
I think it's probably multifactorial. It's like being on a fixed income. It might be living in isolation. It might be not thinking about it. I've also had some older adults that I talk to that have kind of a fatalistic or nihilistic attitude, like, if I survive Cascadia happens, I'd rather it just take me out. And I'm always like, Wow, okay, that's a different perspective than I have heard from other community members, but I think it's like, it's going to be so huge and so catastrophic, like there's no way I could prepare for it. And so I think that's real, they're being honest and sharing a perspective. And so that's something that I consider as part of why preparedness may not happen or be on the forefront of minds. And it also just takes time. And I think some of this stuff is heavy, like jugs of water are heavy. And so if we think through all the different reasons and physical and mental abilities, there's a lot of, yeah, multifaceted reasons. I think it can be hard.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Deborah, you had a question?
Yeah, I was wondering about disaster zones. I don't know if you talked about that. I was about 8 minutes late, but disaster zones, like in like we have disaster zones here in Ashland. And I know I've known my zone number, you know, and then I forget it. And so I know in a panic, I would think a lot of people, I mean, how does that work in terms of, like, for example, does this alert system, Oregon Alert, do they alert you if there's a disaster and do they automatically give you a zone since you've put in your zip code? Or how is that something that, you know, somebody that's just panicking can remember the zone that they're supposed to go to?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not familiar with the zones, and I wonder,
is that Ashland specific?
My neighborhood, it might be. Oh, sorry. Looks like there's some answers in the room.
Eileen, yeah.
Or I did have an answer. Was that, were you going to do that, Anne?
Yeah, but go ahead.
Okay. In Ashland, at least, they, as part of our emergency planning, they have designated evacuation zones. And they mailed it out to every household, and it's on the website. With the idea being, especially as I put in the chat, the limited arterial ways to exit this area, the idea is that they want to be able to alert you on NICSL which zones are evacuating and which they really want you to stay put so that you don't just block the roads for the people who have the fire at their tail, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but I couldn't agree more, Deborah, that in a crisis, probably won't be functioning well. I know I personally, okay, I've got a post on my bulletin board and I put it in my phone, but I suspect it might be the reverse, that the NICSL you get may not be neighborhood specific. It may be 97520 specific, and it's telling you zones 1, 2, and 3 need to evacuate. And there you'll be going, well, what am I?
Yeah,
that's a tough one. I think it's so new for our community. It's going to take a lot of repetition in education, a lot of reinforcement until we begin to lock. I am zone 9. I think I got that right. But I actually don't even trust my memory now. Am I? Or is that just what I think, you know?
And you might not be in your zone. That's the other thing. So,
well, and God help me, I'm not remembering every zone in the city. yeah, tricky.
I don't know whether Oregon has this or not, but I was driving to Lake Tahoe, and I got this on my phone, and it was like flash, or what do you call it? Rock slide ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, how did they know where I was? And, you know, so I got it right, you know, it was right ahead of me.
Huh. Wow.
Huh. Interesting.
That might be a cell phone technology.
Yeah,
they are able to ping off whatever cell tower you're closest to. And that's a way that they will be able to do some push alerts to whoever is in that region. But I would agree with your sentiments about numbers. We had the same issues. Was level 1 the one where you need to leave, or level 3 the one where you need to leave? And I think as much as we can encourage our emergency managers and public health to be as clear and plain language as possible, that will help people, because you're totally correct. Our brains do not work super well when we're stressed.
Probably have time for one more question. I see, Natalie, you have your hand up.
Thanks, Mike. And this is just building off of Anne's question, when she got that push alert about the rock slide. Like, I'm wondering if, Anne, you have the sort of locate your device, you know, when apps can track it on, or if people have opted to disable that, if they would still get push alerts, Lauren, or can those override, you know, things that people might have turned off on their phone to protect their privacy?
Right. So I, within, at least on an iPhone, there's the, in settings and notifications, I don't know if you'll be able to see this, see all my dumb apps on here too, but you can opt to turn on Amber Alerts, emergency alerts, public safety alerts, and even do a test alert. And Oregon is also rolling out a brand new earthquake early warning system, Shake Alert. And so that's an app you can download onto your phone to try to provide advance notice. At this time, they're thinking it might be 15 to 20 seconds, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it's enough to pull over when you're driving, for example, or get under a sturdier, safe structure, or evacuate a building that's going to fall apart and collapse on you. So that's something they're actually doing some rollout meetings next week, or this week. I haven't looked at my calendar far enough ahead, but they're working on that. And that was something that actually really helped to save a lot of lives in Japan for some of their earthquakes. They're quite a ways ahead of us in terms of preparedness and resiliency. But we are using some of their tools as models for what we need to have here for Cascadia. Thank you all. I really appreciate it. I'll put my email here in the chat too, in the event that anyone would like to follow up. And I,
And Lauren, I'll connect with you. I hope that you'll be able to share your slides. And
yeah,
you do that after the presentation so that we can post it with the meeting. It's a public meeting, but I'll also send it out to everybody. And I think that's really helpful. All these folks are ambassadors to our community and can share.
Right.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much, Lauren, for your presentation today. We appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
Okay.
All right. I'll leave you to it.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
Bye.
Hey, Natalie, so are you able to capture the things from that are in the chat that you could send out to the group?
I sure can. Yeah, I can download that as a file. So let me make a note to send that on to everyone.
Yeah, that way we can have time to process it or
save it
someplace.
Yep, I'll get that out probably tomorrow.
And can I ask you something that Lauren just shared? Because when she was talking, I opened my iPhone under settings. Natalie, do you know where under settings those alerts are that you set for emergency or for public alert or safety alerts? And
I will probably have to look into that. I don't know exactly if she was talking about like the Oregon alert system or if there's something.
It was on her iPhone, and it was
okay. I don't have an iPhone. I have an Android, so
I'll try to find out online, Deborah. And we'll try.
I was looking, and I just can't find it.
Right. We may need our device tutors to help.
Let me also just recommend Googling it. I would just type into Google, you know, access emergency alert settings on iPhone, and you can probably walk yourself through it pretty easily.
Yeah. Okay. That was my second option. Yeah. I thought I'd ask you first.
Well, it's always worth a shot.
Very good. Okay, that was an excellent presentation, and I think we're still pretty much on schedule. So we'll move to the next item on our agenda, which is the election of officers. Also, I have here discuss member terms and recruitment for positions opening July 1st. So
you want me to initiate that, Mike?
Sure.
Okay. So we mentioned at the end of the last meeting that we have two members whose terms are finishing. Kathy McNeil is finishing, but she has the option of renewing, and we can hear from her in a moment. And Sandy has already completed two terms, so by our bylaws, she needs to take at least a year off. So, Kathy, did you decide whether you would like to renew or finish?
I think I'm finishing.
Okay. It's been wonderful to have you serve, but I know how much you enjoy, and I certainly know how much you contribute working in our office instead, and that maybe is a better fit. So that means we have two openings, and I will go through the process of posting that because it does need to be publicly noticed about recruitment. But maybe we can do our officer election. I'll explain that. And then maybe we can come back to a brief brainstorm or put it in the chat if anybody has some suggestions about recruitment. I think I tried to get you all started on thinking about that. It has been most effective for us in the past. Most of our members have been personally recruited. It doesn't mean we can't have someone just see it and respond, but we've done better being proactive. And that's also helped us make sure we have a good diversity of representation of people from, you know, all different sectors, including different professional backgrounds and economic backgrounds. So in terms of electing officers, it is in our bylaws that we elect our officers every year, but we also don't have any limits. Someone can run for chair again and continue being our chair. And same with co-chair. So right now, Mike, you've done a wonderful job being our chair. Are you just 1 year or 2 years in? I can't remember.
I think it's three. Oh, no, two.
And Deborah was kind enough to be willing to be co-chair, which mostly is a role of facilitating the meeting. If the chair is not available, or I think we call it vice chair, and we would involve the chair and the vice chair on recruitment and kind of interviewing of new members. So that might become a more active role than Deborah's experienced so far. So I see that Anne has her hand up, and then maybe we can hear from Mike and Deborah whether they want to run again and if anybody else wants to run. So Anne? Oh, you're muted.
I was just nominating them to run again.
Ah, excellent. Mike and Deborah, are you willing to run again?
Yeah, I have one more year left in me.
Okay, and how about you, Deborah?
Yes, I accept.
Okay.
And nomination.
And this is probably your role, Michael, to lead the, are there any other nominations and a vote?
Are there any other nominations for chair? Any other nominations for vice chair? Okay, then the motion on the floor is for Mike Gardner to continue as chair of ASAC and Deborah Johnson to continue as vice chair. For ASAC, we had a motion. I think we had a second, did we not?
I second if we don't.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'd say everyone, all in favor can say aye or raise their hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? None.
Can I ask who motioned?
Ann motioned and Jim seconded. And we just did both the chair and vice chair in the same motion for convenience. It'll be trickier next year. So
well,
then we can circle back to recruiting.
Yeah, thank you. So I guess I'd just like to invite, are there any ideas for recruitment that anybody would like to bring forward now? And yeah.
Well, I would just add, you know, that now that the city seems to be a little more proactive, not only in the newsletter, but, you know, you can sign up to get regular alerts on about activities going on. In fact, I see a lot of senior center activities listed in that. I think to me, that would be a good place to add, you know, that we didn't have available to us last year, I don't believe. You know, in addition to the APRC website and, you know, and I imagine the senior news as well.
Great, all great suggestions. So we'll work on that advertising.
And
I would just say that Kathy and Natalie and Eileen know the, I guess, consumers, you know, participants, I guess, in the senior program. And I think Kathy has been an exemplary representative of the views of that group. And many of us are not as actively involved in the day-to-day operations of the senior program. So hopefully you three might you know, definitely focus on some of the participants for as a pool.
I think we've also talked about in the past, you know, trying to make the group a bit more multi-generational if we can. I mean, we don't all have to be seniors to, you know, participate in this. I don't know if there's a logical way to see if there's any younger members of the community that might be interested, but just a consideration. Deborah?
Well, and Anne, you can chime in about this, but what do you think about Karen Stewart?
Yeah.
She's younger, she's 57.
Well, and also representing the university student, because she's of that age and her chronological age, but she's also a student at SOU. So I think that's a group that is not as engaged with the community in general and with its governance, and would benefit from that voice. And Noriko has been very active in SOU is an age-friendly university. I think there's an interest on the part of the university to have that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Any other suggestions from the committee on either, also if you know a particular individual, like Deborah and Anne just pointed out, it'd be worth, you know, coordinating with Eileen and pursuing that as well.
That'd be great. Yeah. I really appreciate all the brainstorming on sort of the concepts and the PR. That's very helpful. And perhaps I can include in the messaging and press release about our invitation for, you know, not just seniors are welcome, but anybody who's engaged in and interested in issues affecting seniors and family caregivers, for instance, because we have pointed out so frequently that senior issues are also fam issues.
Yeah. The other person, did Anne go? The other person, well, and I know we'll contact you, Eileen, but the other person that the potential is artist Lynn. She's an retired attorney, and she might be interested.
Okay, great. Maybe I'm realizing that I should have been thoughtful that this is a public and recorded meeting, so we probably don't want to get into detail about individuals, but great to have some names to follow up on. Right. And I see Noriko has.
Yeah, Noriko.
Thank you. I wonder, Sandy, if you have any idea that the person in the medical or clinical field like you.
Mm.
Yeah, Sandy?
I'm sorry, I didn't know you were asking me.
Oh, sorry. I wonder if you know someone in the medical or clinical field.
The medical or clinical.
Yeah, I'll think about that.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure you all know that Sandy brought nursing and nursing leadership background. As Corey is a retired nurse as well. But that is a valuable perspective. And something from what somebody else said about the age-friendly initiative at the SOU, and I'm thinking the hospital also has a group. It's possible that one of those committee members on either side, SOU or the hospital, might see the value in cross-fertilizing. And since, Sandy, we're losing you as our cross-fertilization to the hospital age-friendly group, maybe there's somebody else that you could nudge a little bit.
I will talk with
Steve.
Steve Hirsch and see if he has a suggestion.
Great.
Wonderful.
Good suggestion, Noriko. Thank you.
Yeah, so any individuals that you might think are, could potentially be a fit, let's just direct those into Eileen and then Deborah and myself and Eileen and anyone else that wants to get involved with potentially interviewing or screening candidates. We'll organize that over the next month or so to try to have something together by July.
If there's anybody who wants to be in a work group to do that interviewing, let me know. It's sort of been past chairs mostly that had a lot at stake. So Anne's been good about participating, and Sandy did in the past. I think we've let you off now that you're a few past, but we'd welcome you if you wanted. Okay.
All right.
Thank you. That's what we needed. Thank you so much. Right.
Okay, let's move on to standing reports, and I'll turn it over to Commissioner Jim Bachman for comments on APRC.
Right, I have a couple this afternoon. One, and they're both budget related. We're in the budget season, planning for a new biennium starting on July 1st. Mike's one of the members of the committee, as is Bob Kaplan, who's the liaison from council sitting in today. But it's an important time for us at the commission. We've asked for what we think we need. We did a bottom-up analysis. We've asked for what we think we need to fulfill our mission across the board in parks, recreation, and senior services, rather than trying to guess what we would get. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out, what the budget committee recommends and what the council finally adopts. Related to our requests. We are hoping to rebuild our employment levels to pre-pandemic staffing so that we can do a little better job with all of three divisions, and including senior services. It would be nice to begin to do what we want to do instead of finding ways to get by with less. So that's I've combined the two items there, but those are the two things. One is just watching the budget process to see how it plays out. The other is getting started on rebuilding our staffing numbers so that we have a more effective organization. So that's kind of where the APRC is spending its energy right now.
Any questions for Jim from committee members?
Does the budget include the reinstatement of a staffing person for senior services?
Not specifically, but there are positions that could be staffed. In other words, we have several, I think four or five that we're trying to fill that could be in any three of the divisions. And so there's a possibility that maybe a half a person again or something. We don't know yet. We need to see how much money we're going to get, but we did ask for enough for, I can't remember if it's four or five additional positions that are at that, the level of office work, administrative assistance, that sort of thing. And then we also want, and this is helpful in the sense that it improves our oversight of the entire organization. We want to fill the park superintendent position, which has been open now for 2 or 3 years, to give our director more time to do top end work. So we're just trying to get back to being fully functional. We were early cutting back because we're very flexible, and we want to be early getting back staffed because we're flexible, and we need to do that to do our job.
Follow up, Ian?
Well, I'm just going to reiterate the demographic information that we talked about with the disaster preparedness. You know, when you have close to 27% of the population age 65 plus. That's pretty extraordinary, and the navigation and support needs go along with it. And so, I mean, I appreciate the need to support the whole parks administrative function, but I certainly hope that we get more staffing as a result of the allocation of some of the positions that are being funded.
I'll be an advocate for that in at the commission level.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate that. Next, I'll bring in City Council Liaison, Mr. Kaplan.
Great. Thanks, everybody. So I guess a couple things from the council. One is very apropos of the presentation that we had today on disaster preparedness. Just to make sure everybody knows that we, at the last council meeting, approved a agreement, intergovernmental agreement between the City of Ashland, SOU, and the Ashland School District for our Emergency Operations Center operations. So really trying to put together resources, shared resources for emergency operations. And Ashland, the city, is putting in one staff person for that. That's Kelly Burns, who comes from the fire department and is now our full-time emergency operations coordinator, coordinates with those two other entities and also with the county, because the county has an emergency management person. It strikes me that it might be useful to invite Kelly to come to this meeting, much as we had the presentation from Lauren today. And, you know, because I think there's potential opportunities to, you know, use facilities, use this facility here where we're located, this senior center, in case of an emergency operations, and what kind of things would we need to store here in order to, you know, make sure that it's equipped for different kinds of emergency operations. One of the things that I participated in a week ago, a couple of us did, and there were people from the school district and the university as well, is an active shooter training. We didn't talk about that as emergency operations, but that's also something that, you know, you see going on around the country. It's not a very likely occurrence, but it is something that is useful to be trained in if should it happen. And then the other thing that I just mentioned in terms of liaison report from the council is we had a presentation from Paige West from Rogue Valley Transportation District. I think you may have seen in our news that where there's going to be a new intra Ashland circulator on a route that's going to cover more of our community. I know that Eileen had expressed some concern that might be instead of a circulator, because a circulator is certainly very useful for people that are off that route and maybe, you know, more mobility impaired. And Paige West talked about that it is not a substitute. It's at this point, they don't, our Rogue Valley Transportation District doesn't have staffing for a connector. But that's still on the agenda for future bringing back the connector when there's an opportunity. So those are two things that I would leave with you, and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Bob? Okay. We let you off easy today.
Yeah, good.
Thank you. Next, we'll move on to education report from Natalie.
Thank you, Mike. And I'm just going to share what Eileen had just put in the chat, but I also had the privilege to attend the first of the two city active shooter trainings. So it was great to have that knowledge and then come back to the senior center and take a look at our facility and see how we could apply that in terms of where can you barricade, where are the exits, you know, and pretty informally, me and Eileen went over a game plan. And then I also talked with the staff, the Food and Friends staff who run the meal program, about what we would recommend they would do in what is hopefully a very unlikely event. But also, that's great that the city is offering these trainings. We're very grateful to have that. In terms of education, I kind of just want to focus on three new or time limited things that we're doing that are exciting about pushing into new directions. The first one is that for May and June, it's not really education, but it's one of our programs, but we're offering outdoor line dancing. So we do actually have a dedicated activity that's using our outdoor activity space. It's a nice group to sort of pilot that. You know, it's an extension of our weekly line dancing class, so it's been pretty easy to transition folks that are already used to engaging with us into this new space, and their patience as the weather fails to cooperate with us for outdoor activities. But we're really excited. It was just cool to watch people using that space outside for one of our activities. Hopefully it bodes well for us bringing more things into that space. The two others are related to our continuing interest in developing more digital education for seniors. So I want to thank Corey Frank, who was down here with a couple of her fellow volunteers today for the first session of the digital supermarket coupon tutoring, which is really exciting to teach people how to use those apps on their smartphone and that they can immediately get benefits by stretching their income at local supermarkets. So thank you, Corey. And thanks also to Alyssa Jelinek, the SOU student who also works at Albertsons, who trained all of them and made a really wonderful brochure. And in relation to that, Eileen and I are working on a 10-week practicum with two OHSU nursing students who are helping us delve a little bit more into what the needs and barriers are for local seniors accessing and using digital technology, particularly internet-based technology. We hope that, so they've already done some one-on-one interviews. They're going to be implementing a survey. It'll help us really build out the landscape better to see where the needs are and what the barriers are so we can try to design our programming to address those. And that's it.
Any questions for Natalie? Okay, seeing none, I will turn it over to Senior Services Superintendent Eileen Glatt.
Right. And I want to thank Natalie. I appreciate everybody being very focused because we had a long presentation at the start. But do be aware that Natalie's done a great job of building out an almost monthly education on a variety of topics. And you can always see that lineup in our newsletter that you all get or on the website if you want to look ahead. Oh, Natalie.
Thank you, Eileen. I meant to mention that our June presentation is actually specifically on disaster preparation for older adults. So I wanted to bring that. So we're going to have Bill Bateman, who has taught at SOU and done a lot of teaching about disaster preparedness, come and give a presentation in person that is specific to how older adults should prepare for their go bag and everything like that. So just spread the word, but it's very much on our radar that we want people to be aware and we want to empower them to be able to prepare themselves.
So as always, there's a lot of detail in my my report to you. I just had three things to highlight. Thank you, Bob, for bringing up about the new Route 17 circulator, and I do have, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I have absolutely been concerned about whether that's going to edge out the Ashland Connector. I feel like for our senior community, while people will benefit from having this route that lets, for instance, a lot more of our community take a bus to the hospital, that's one of the ways it will connect on the new route. I think for those of you who don't normally take the bus, the Route 10 is kind of a through route, and then it turns around, covers a little bit around Ashland Street and comes back again, back on Siskiyou. So that's really helpful, and that connects people to the rest of the county, but it doesn't connect a lot of our town. And the circulator route will provide many more connections, but it's not going to address that issue of going up the hill. Or here, I'll point from my office up the hill. So for seniors, we really heard what a game changer the Ashland Connector is. And I want to thank Bob and Paula, who both really took the time to have a tour at Ashland Senior Center. And each wanted to know what the issues were. And so they've been in the stands, you know, advocating for us. And it really helps to have two of our council members being very mindful of that. As all of you, as you do your advocacy in the community. It's great to hear from Paige that she foresees being able to have both, because I served, gosh, I want to say 5 or 6 years on an advisory committee for RB2D, and I heard consistently that it was a choice, that there was money for one or the other. So if Paige is now seeing more money in their resources, maybe because the state tax and the employee tax is coming in at higher than originally projected is my guess, but I don't know, because I turned off that and I'm no longer serving. So that's good news. And I really thank you, Bob, for being able to represent. I was actually on vacation when I saw that story, and I sent out an emergency cry for help to people who were going to be at that council meeting. So thanks so much. Helps so much to have that liaison back and forth. Another piece of advocacy that I have mentioned to you in the past is I have put it out to a number of our city departments and to the city manager and assistant city manager, who also asked me where the gaps were for seniors, that the utility discount that the city offers for seniors, I became aware that the federal poverty level rates that utility discount is based on, which there's two different discount rates based on 100% of federal poverty or 125%, are just so, so low. I've had so many conversations with very impoverished seniors just trying to get any kind of a break. And not qualifying for it, you know, making $50 too much a month. And about a year ago, I was listening to a webinar, and someone from the Medicare and Medicaid Center said, someone asked them, well, what's the qualification for Medicaid? And she said it's 138 to 150% of poverty. And I just never heard the Medicaid broken down so clearly. And I was like, Medicare is about Medicaid, the low income subsidy for seniors, is about the lowest bar for qualifying that there should be. And the fact that our senior utility was so much lower really got me going on advocating. And I haven't heard the outcome. Obviously, that discount has to compete with all the other needs that have to get funded in this budget. But Paula let me know the other day that she is keeping that in mind. And Bob, perhaps it sounded like you've sometimes been in some of these discussions, that the city councils are really trying to look at the, not just the income levels, but the big picture of how those utility discounts work and all the extra fees that have been loaded on utilities and the impact on our lower income citizens. So I thank you all for continuing to carry that torch, Bob and Paula and others. And I'm just going to end with a really sweet note, a little story this morning. One of our volunteers who does computer and device tutoring, and she's been with us for a number of years, she tells us she's way more patient than she was when she was younger. She helps so many people figure out their devices. Well, she comes in every week and she gets our newsletter. And because of being here, she saw that Natalie did a great job working with the Lions, setting up a display to really highlight what the Lions Club does for both hearing aids and for eyeglasses. And because she was in our building, because she's in touch with us, she heard about their hearing aids. Her hearing aids wore out. She realized it was extremely expensive to replace them. She worked with Lions, and she has a beautiful, wonderful new pair of hearing aids for her $50 copay with them. And so I just wanted to share that story of synergy and connections and opportunities. So just touched my heart this morning. I'll stop there, but I see I'm starting to adjust.
Go ahead, Ann. You're muted.
Wanted to give you kudos, Eileen and Natalie and Kathy, because I know you all contributed to this, the system for tracking our participants and really impressive numbers of the people that are active participants, much, much greater than in the past, and speaks to the importance of having restructured this program to serve more people in Ashland. So thank you.
Right. Thank you all. Okay, let's move on to items from ASAC members or work groups. I'll just mention really briefly on the update on the May ballot measure 15214. That's the asking the voters about reallocating the food and beverage tax to fund operations for parks, recreation, and senior services. I think the question is pretty straightforward. Hopefully everyone's voted, and if your friends haven't voted, you could ask them to make sure they vote on May 16th or by May 16th. I think it's important. So that's all I have to say on that, unless there's any questions. Seeing none, move on to the Livable Ashland Alliance update to Sandy and to Ann.
Well, I'll just mention that I was looking at the minutes, and it's actually not too much different than last time. We continue to work with the Ashland Community Health Foundation to have them consider being our fiscal agent. Ann's really done most of the work on that, so I give her kudos. And we continue to meet and to exchange ideas, but that's kind of where we're going, feeling that in order to be successful, we need to move to that level, and it's a work in process.
Anything to add, Ann?
Just that I think that's the step that's needed to start engaging the citizens in this effort and making them feel a part of what's going on. I think we might very shortly thereafter, hopefully we'll get this resolved in the next couple months, maybe come back to the council or perhaps city administration with an update on what we're doing, and also inviting in people from the city administration and council to start funneling both the things that have been going on since February 2020 when we joined the network, as well as making suggestions as for initiatives. That's more that participation that I think we're gearing up for.
Okay. I have one final thing to bring up, but I'll open the floor if there's any other items that anyone would like to briefly touch on before we adjourn for the day. Well, seeing none, I just wanted to make sure that we show our appreciation to both Sandy and Kathy for the service to this group. It's important. You guys are stalwarts. You show up to every meeting. You help out. You get involved with the community, and it's ultimately important for not only the senior community but for all of us that that help try to participate and try to make Ashland a better place. So I want to personally thank both of you for your time on this committee.
I'll just say thank you. I really enjoyed it. You know, starting out, as several of you did, I mean, we kind of all started out with this new rendition.
Yeah, new idea.
of the committee, and it's been a real positive experience, and I really enjoyed it, and I just can't say how much I appreciate Eileen and Natalie and the support that they give to seniors and to, you know, and to this committee. So thank you, and I really enjoyed it. Thanks. I will miss you, actually.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I also want to say thank you, and I've gotten a lot of good information to take back to the Senior Center with me, and I probably will continue to attend part of your meetings, but more as getting more information to take back from the presenters that we've had. And I want to thank you all.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your advocacy, and stay with us as long as you can. Okay. All right. Not seeing any other hands. I think that's all we have for today. Thanks everyone for showing up, and we'll be back together July 10th for another Zoom meeting of ASAP. So thanks a lot. Meeting adjourned. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.